You are listening to CJSF 90.1 FM on your dial, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. And you are listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenery, professional engineer, professional futurist, and sometimes occasional sessional instructor of future studies at Simon Fraser University. And this is a weekly show that looks at future trends and issues and important items that affect your daily life and will be affecting your life into the future. Welcome to the show. We're continuing our look at the book The Mind of the CEO by Jeffrey E. Garton. Last show we were looking at the next internet wars. By the fall of the year 2000, many of the new economy icons were badly tarnished. Microsoft and Intel had lost huge percentages of their market capitalization, and the business models of Amazon, Pipeline, Yahoo, and eBay were increasingly questioned by financial analysts and investors for their long-term viability. Popular commentary focused on the folly of Wall Street and the media for having overhyped the new internet companies. A new line of thinking was evident. Traditional firms would absorb the better ideas which the dot-com spawned. Virtually every smart idea a dot-com entrepreneur has ever dreamed up has been duplicated by established concerns with deep pockets and staying power, said Businessweek. Having exalted the new economy for years, however, the media was now going too far in the other direction of implying that the dot-coms were history or that the old line firms had the internet in their DNA. True, the revolution was spreading to the traditional companies, but it was nowhere complete in terms of technological development and certainly not in terms of the ability of corporate management and the workforce to fully incorporate everything the internet offered. In fact, as Leonard Riggio said, revolution and evolution were coexisting, and a new kind of mega firm was just beginning to emerge. And so the big question for multinational companies is not whether they will be thrown off course by the newer internet companies, but how they, every one of them internet-enabled, will compete with one another. Because of the internet, all prices will be transparent and subject to comparison, a far-reaching change in the business climate, where real comparison shopping on a global scale was never possible before, either for consumers or businesses themselves. Companies will be using the internet to communicate better with their customers and suppliers, knit their far-flung workers closer together, mine their considerable knowledge scattered throughout their empires, reduce costs with more efficient inventory management, and otherwise streamline operations. In doing all of this, they will all become more productive, and they will create an environment so hyper-competitive that it will be almost impossible to raise prices. In fact, they may well be competing in an increasingly deflationary environment that they themselves will have helped to create. A lot of us will benefit in our capacity as consumers who are getting more value for our purchases, but not as shareholders of the companies whose profitability is under extreme pressure. The cutthroat environment will make it nearly impossible to hold any kind of lead by virtue of innovation or product differentiation for long. Overall, the internet spawn challenge that CEOs will face in the next several years will be different in kind and far greater degree than they faced in the late 1990s. What then will separate the winners from the losers? Success will depend not only on technology, but on leadership, management, and strategy. The point is made by Orit Gadesh, the flamboyant chairman of the global consulting firm Bain & Company, and a former soldier in the Israeli army, just back from a six-week trip to visit clients throughout Europe and Asia. She talked excitedly about the importance of fitting an e-business strategy into a company's approach to serving its customers, not as something apart. There is a tendency to obsess about having an e-commerce strategy, but this is the wrong way to think about it, she said. You need an overall strategy, of which e-commerce is the important part. She referred to recent decisions at Levi Strauss. The firm had a brilliant website, but had recently shut it down because the price of sales over the internet was out of line with retail sales in stores. According to Gadish, the company needed to think through its overall sales strategy first and then figure out how the various sales channels fit together. Jack Welch embodies the philosophy that the internet must be an enabler of basic business strategies. You use the internet to do what you want to do faster and more efficiently, but your fundamental objectives don't change. We are already using the internet to become quicker, to squeeze more costs out of the system, to take intermediaries out of the transactions. We have a strategy, and the internet makes it more effective, he says. Welch searched for a piece of paper to illustrate his point. He walked to his desk, picked up a document, brought it back to where we were sitting, and started scribbling on the back of it. On one side of the page, he wrote GE, and on the other side of the page, he wrote customer. He drew a two-headed arrow between them. His concept was a simple one. GE is about finding and keeping customers. Use the internet any way you can and experiment with as many different approaches as you can to enhance your company's relationship with the customer. But never allow anyone, a .com or any other company, to get in the middle of this relationship. He paused after the second, anyone, his eyes flashing, the nonverbal equivalent of an exclamation mark. Gee, he had never allowed any interlopers before the internet, he said, and nothing had changed except that GE now had to provide its customers with whatever a .com intermediary could deliver. If the customer needed more information, he said, his people would see how the internet could be used to provide it to dispense more and better information. If prices were not competitive, GE would figure out how the internet could be used to reduce cost of supplies or inventories. In other words, the business fundamentals don't change. Only the tools do. Welch leaves little doubt that there is no room in his empire for employees who don't learn how to use those tools. A crucial differentiator will also be employees. Their energy levels, their adaptability, their willingness to experiment and to take risks. I think if there's anything to worry about, it's whether or not you've got the energy in the organization to truly understand the rapidity in which the impact of the internet is going to happen, said Welch. My people understand it, but we don't yet have the entire organization engaged. The internet is not yet all-consuming. So I guess the biggest challenge is, can we get enough energy, enough excitement, enough momentum into people's bodies to be sure they're reacting and leading this revolution? Because it is truly a revolution. A third factor in winning the internet wars will come down to the business model. That is how CEOs make the most of all their assets, customers, employees, suppliers, relationships with communities and governments. And particularly, how can they get value from each, and how can they tie them together so that the total value is more than the sum of its parts? In this regard, the internet is the key tool because it can enhance communication as no other medium has been able to do. It can integrate the constituencies of a company by allowing them to share information and act almost simultaneously on it, such as when a customer's order in Kansas City must be filled in Kuala Lumpur, or when the blueprints of a new project are being designed by teams of architects amid engineers living in many different parts of the world. No one can tell what the best business models will be in the future. And in any event, they are likely to be constantly changing and evolving. In this uncertain environment, we can expect a series of landmark business deals, each of which creates a potentially new trend. When AOL announced its merger with Time Warner, most observers were stunned, but soon afterwards the logic of linking old and new media seemed inevitable. If tomorrow's Walmart brought Amazon.com or Merrill Lynch linked up with Priceline.com, new precedents would be set. The point is that the market will be experimenting with combinations that few thought of initially. Some of these dynamic experiments will be colossal failures, whereas others will continue and constitute a new direction that other companies will emulate. We are also on the cusp of all kinds of new markets in finance and business, not just markets where you buy and sell a product on the basis of price, but where you simultaneously have access to enormous amounts of information about the people and institutions you are dealing with. Take one example. An auto company won't just buy a steering wheel online. It will also know whether the makers of that part are environmentally conscious. Just a few years from now, billions of people, and that's not hyperbole, will carry cell phones with access to the internet, a situation whose impact on business, let alone on politics and economics, defies imagination. In 1996, the late Jerry Junkins, the chairman and CEO of Texas Instruments, gave me some advice about designing courses at Yale that take account of the internet. Assume that all information everywhere will be available to everyone at no cost, he said. That's about where we'll be in the early part of the next century. It seems as though we're getting there, but it would be wrong to think that that's the end point. It's just the beginning of the beginning. This much is sure. Company structure will have to be redesigned over and over. Experiments in strategies, projects, and people will be continual. Those organizations that are uncomfortable living on the edge are unlikely to win the brutally competitive contest in which they find themselves with old and new players from around the corner to around the world. You can count on this as well. The most successful CEOs will be able to accommodate whatever trends emerge and whatever curveballs are thrown, in large part because they will never lose sight of their fundamental strategies: to win over customers, surround themselves with the most talented people, enhance the reputation of their brands, and incessantly communicate their strategies to investors, customers, and employees. The winning business model will include not just concepts, but execution. How closely can you link a company to its customers? How skilled are you in creating an efficient worldwide supply system that, among its other virtues, eliminates the need for costly inventories on site? How good are you at managing your outsourcing and your strategic alliances with other companies? Can you provide new product offerings on a fluid and continuous basis, rather than at intervals of one or more years? Can you put together special teams to accomplish specific projects and then disband them and establish different ones quickly and effectively? Can you make decisions quickly? Can you kill a project early if it appears that the initial decision was wrong? Can you create an environment that promotes collaboration? Can you reward people who make this happen? In the brutal wars among internet-enabled companies, there are some of the attributes that winning CEOs will need. No one can confidently predict where the internet will take us any more than someone could have known how swiftly the steam engine would lead to industrialization, or how radically the telegraph would revolutionize financial markets, or how the railroad would lead to the formation of national and global companies, and that the automobile would create suburbs, and so on. All we can be certain of is that the internet will have a pivotal influence on how we produce and distribute goods, how we receive and disseminate information, how we communicate on every level. It will empower customers in ways still only dimly imaginable, and will change the structure of heavy industry, telecommunications, energy, finance, media, healthcare, leisure, and recreation, and much more. It will create what management expert Peter Drucker calls the new mental geography, in which distance is eliminated and there's only one economy and only one market, global in both cases. As the internet becomes a contest not between the traditional companies and the dot-coms, but among the big boys themselves, it will become a battle among corporations with enormous resources and geographical reach, fought on terrain where price increases are almost impossible and achieving monopoly positions is increasingly difficult under the intense glare of antitrust government watchdogs. The financial markets will be passing judgments on winners and losers every day, taking account of plans, execution, and quarterly profits. The wars to come are sure to be bloody.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. And you're listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenary. We're now going to take a short break and listen to a very important public service announcement.
Every year, countless people succumb to the temptation to purchase exotic animals like hedgehogs, lizards, monkeys, even tigers and bears to keep as pets. But life in captivity is often a death sentence for these animals, who may suffer from malnutrition, an improper environment, and the stress of confinement. For more information on this issue, visit the BCSPCA website at www.spca.bc.ca.
Welcome back. You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. And you are listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenary, professional futurist.
Welcome back. We are looking at the book, The Mind of the CEO by Jeffrey E. Garton. We're now on chapter 3, Being Global. The merger that created Daimler Chrysler, says Honeywell chairman and CEO Michael Bonsignori, was really one of the pivotal events in my thinking. Boeing, McDonnell Douglas, ExxonMobil, you saw these combinations and you thought, my goodness, all bets are off. There's no more conventional wisdom on what is possible. I began to think of the stewardship of a 114-year-old company, asking myself, is a $10 billion company going to survive into the next decade? Bonsignori's anxieties led to a major change for his company. In late 1999, Honeywell merged with Allied Signal to form a new firm, Honeywell International, with three times the sales of the old Honeywell. Bonsignori then faced the challenge of putting together two distinct cultures. His company, with its anti-conglomerate stick-in-your-knitting philosophy, and Allied Signal, which was a multi-market, multi-product corporation prone to go after markets, even if they were relatively unassociated with one another. As it turned out, the new entity struggled to deliver on its promise right from the beginning. During the year 2000, shareholders drove down the market value by over 30%. In October 2000, Bonsignori helped engineer another mega deal, this time putting the company in the arms of GE. Now size and uniform culture would be better assured, but at the cost of Honeywell's existence altogether. Bonsignori's thinking and the headaches he took on because of the original transaction are hardly unusual. Nevertheless, I found that many top business leaders have been involved in international business for so long that they may be overconfident that they truly understand the nature of the game. Some have lived and worked abroad. Some have managed large projects and operations or engineered financial deals that encompass several countries. Important as the world economy is to them, and as aware as they were of intensifying competition for world markets, I did not detect the same enthusiasm, urgency, or imagination in their discussions of global strategies as I did when talking about the internet. I did not sense the same awareness that just as it was critical for the internet to become part of a company's DNA, so it is essential for a company to have global mentality that was deeply embedded in all it did. Among other things, that would mean having a global vision, a global strategy, a global hiring system, a global training program, a global procurement and supply system, and global R&D operations. It would mean coming to grips with the tensions between having one corporate culture and one which also included people and markets of many different national cultures. It would imply creating a global system of financial and psychological incentives that align these activities and interests of every part of the company with this central vision and strategy. To be sure, none of these issues is new to CEOs of multinational companies, and many chief executives are seized with them at the moment. But in the new economy, they often appear as yesterday's problems because they've been around for so long, and they're not as sexy as the internet. But in fact, is that no one has yet found the right formulas to deal with them satisfactorily. So the relative complacency I felt is likely to be a major liability for many CEOs. After all, when it comes to global strategy, here too the ground is shifting. Not long ago, the essence of a successful corporate foray into the international arena was to expand into as many countries as possible. But today, any.com can hawk its products from Baltimore to Brisbane without moving from its founder's spare bedroom. Multinational corporations once scoured the earth for low-cost labor and production facilities, while today the premium for most companies is finding highly skilled talent around the world, no matter the price. There was a time when big global companies were really pure reflections of their national cultures and policies, but the successful corporation will soon have to be multinational in a literal sense. There was a time when companies with powerful brands, Coca-Cola, Procter & Gamble, IBM, could sweep into third world markets and blow away the existing companies. But today, tough local competition is emerging in industries such as soft drinks in India and computers in China. While international companies were never simple to run, the size and complexity of the firms are now arising out of the mega mergers raise important fundamental questions about how much is too much for a CEO to effectively manage. As more companies set up the full range of their businesses abroad, including advanced research and development, and more of their subsidiaries become deeply entwined with local strategic alliances, the job of maintaining an intra-company culture will become overwhelming. In addition, CEOs will need to be prepared for the global economy in which so many countries of varying states of sophistication are important markets, and they are for a highly volatile global financial system that is sure to be characterized by recurrent crises. One assumption will have to be discarded is that being big and multinational is itself a competitive advantage, no longer. An increasing number of firms are moving into all corners of the earth, growing by acquisition after acquisition. The decisive difference between success and mediocrity, which is to say between success and failure, will be the ability of each organization to transform global reach into real value for customers all over the world that their competitors simply cannot provide. This task requires more brains than brawn. It involves creating a truly multinational organization to take advantage of the enormous diversity around the world. It requires imagination going well beyond the kinds of recent corporate reorganizations that have focused on the relationship between product lines and geographical reasons. Getting the strategy right will be a never-ending preoccupation for the CEOs who succeed in the wired world market. Not long ago, for most companies, being international meant conducting an import-export business. If an American corporation had some outposts overseas, they were designed to facilitate the movement of goods to and from the United States. Except, of course, for mining and oil companies, little or no production occurred abroad. The next stage in the evolution of global firms came when companies set up overseas branches and subsidiaries to serve specific geographical markets. For example, the Ford Motor Company simply owned a company, say, within England, and Ford would produce cars there for British citizens. But its British operations were usually tightly directed by and heavily dependent on the Detroit Home Office. The same national focus and reporting lines to the United States applied to Ford subsidiaries in France and Japan. Then, in the 1980s, came the multinational company in which the production of foreign subsidiaries was integrated and the end products themselves became internationalized. And this is what we're going to be looking at in future shows, the advent of the multinational corporation. What is the status of the multinational corporation today, and what is the future of the multinational corporation? So please stay tuned.
You have been listening to Future Talk on CJSF 90.1 FM on your dial, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby, and Future Talk is a weekly show on important issues that affect you and your future. And this is Dr. Teneri, professional futurist, reminding you that if you're not willing to make the effort to invent your own future, then others will be only too happy to invent it for you. See you next week.
Listening to CJSF Radio, Simon Fraser, 90.1 FM.
Welcome to Viewpoints on this week's show. Over 700 students from the Louis Riel School Division take learning out of the classroom and onto the land.
To me, learning with the land, it's recognizing that our land, it's not just a resource, it's a relative. The land, I was always taught growing up, had spirit. It was life itself.
Celebrating Grace Annie Lockhart, the first woman to receive a bachelor's degree in the British Empire 150 years ago at Mount Allison University.
For women in that time, it would have been an extremely controlled environment. Any time that they would have left the building to go on a processed walk, they would have been chaperoned by faculty or other women from the community. Men were not allowed to see them. So their lives were very much controlled.
Gray divorces are on the rise across the country.
I call them young women in their 50s, after 25, 30 years of marriage, just deciding, you know, I just want to be, and I don't know whether free is the right word, I guess it is, my own decision maker and in control of my